right, this talk is going to be on drug-drug interactions in transplant recipients. Obviously, realizing that transplant recipients are at high risk for drug misadventures, mainly because of the complexity of our immunosuppressive regimens, the concomitant disease states that often follow with organ transplant, as well as the number of medication these patients are, puts our transplant population at high risk for the development of drug-drug interactions. In general, we can classify drug-drug interactions into two categories: those that result in pharmacokinetic drug interactions and those that result in pharmacodynamic drug interactions. In general, pharmacokinetic interactions are those interactions that result in changes in concentrations in either our immunosuppressive medications, the co-administered medications, or both medications. And a pharmacodynamic drug-drug interaction is where there's no change in concentrations of either our immunosuppressants or co-administered medication, yet there's a change in efficacy or safety. So first, we're going to start out with pharmacokinetic interactions because that's obviously the most common interaction that folks consider when they think about renal transplant or other organ transplant recipients. When we talk about pharmacokinetic interactions, we have to talk about the major aspects of pharmacokinetics, which include absorption, distribution, metabolism, and excretion or elimination. So we'll start with interactions of absorption. So when your patient takes an oral dosage form, whether it be a capsule or a tablet, it must undergo a certain process to allow the drug to be released before it can be absorbed. And the first step you're going to see is you're going to see your oral dosage form undergoing disintegration into large granules, then undergoing dissolution into smaller size particles, which increases the surface area for oral absorption. And the first interaction we see at this first step in our process is an interaction that exists between mycophenolate mofetil and our proton pump inhibitors. And what we see is we have a difficulty in attaining degradation and dissolution under a high gastric pH. So when mycophenolate mofetil and proton pump inhibitors are co-administered in the stomach, there's a reduction in tablet and capsule dissolution and an overall reduction in oral bioavailability. So we generally see about a 25% reduction in overall concentrations when a proton pump inhibitor is co-administered with mycophenolate mofetil. The adverse sequelae of this interaction is truly unknown. The other thing that we can see early on in this process is the potential for chelation interactions. Chelation interactions exist when you give multiple drugs that may bind to one another inside the gut. So imagine co-administering mycophenolic acid with a divalent or a trivalent cation like calcium, aluminum, or magnesium, or with a non-cationic phosphate binder like sevelamer. What will happen if these drugs are co-administered? You get a chelation interaction in the belly, and you never absorb either of these two preparations. And so you get a significant reduction in immunosuppressive activity, as well as the activity of your calcium or your aluminum or your magnesium products. When these drugs are to be co-administered, they need to be separated by 2 hours. So if you have a patient that's taking calcium supplements and mycophenolate mofetil, it's important that a patient is instructed to separate the mycophenolate from the calcium preparation by about 2 hours. One thing to note is this interaction does not exist with iron, despite the fact that it's both a divalent and trivalent cation. We just don't see the same interaction. So those are safe to co-administer. The next step that we have happens inside the intestinal lumen, and we have an active drug which gets absorbed through enterocytes and winds its way into the hepatic circulation. And it can get there in multiple mechanisms. You can have a passive diffusion of the drug through the enterocyte into the hepatic circulation, or it can go through this organic ion transporter protein, which will then bring the drug inside the enterocyte, which can then further be absorbed, or it can undergo metabolic or metabolism by CYP3A, mostly 5 in the gut, to inactive drug or active drug, where this metabolite and drug can either be absorbed or then brought through the transport protein P-glycoprotein and brought back into the intestinal lumen. So the major goal of P-glycoprotein is to remove xenobiotics from tissue. And so in the gut, it's removing metabolites and active drug and sticking it back into the intestinal lumen for excretion through the body. Now, what we can see in this process is a number of different drug interactions. We have drugs that are substrates for OATP and P-glycoprotein. We have drugs that are inhibitors and inducers of these transport proteins. So common drugs like macrolide antibiotics, azole antifungals, non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers can inhibit P-glycoprotein. Drugs like phenytoin, carbamazepine, St. John's wort can induce P-glycoprotein activity. One important drug interaction that we see here is the impact that cyclosporin has. Cyclosporin is an inhibitor of OATP as well as P-glycoprotein, and it's one of the reasons why we see an interaction with cyclosporin in various different statins, in particular simvastatin and atorvastatin, because of this inhibition. And we generally do not see the same impact out of tacrolimus because it doesn't have the same impact here. So obviously, P-glycoprotein and other transport proteins play a large role in the oral absorption of medications. Now, other things that can happen in terms of absorption are when you use prokinetic drugs. So drugs like metoclopramide can increase gastric motility and improve gastric emptying. Those drugs can increase the concentrations of some of our transplant medications, in particular tacrolimus and cyclosporin. Another phenomena that can happen is if you were to get drug-induced adverse events that result in changes in absorption of your transplant medications. So imagine your patient has mycophenolic acid-induced diarrhea. This generally results in an inflammatory process, which actually enhances the oral absorption of your calcineurin inhibitors and your mTOR inhibitors, resulting in increased concentrations where you would have believed that the counter would have been more likely a reduction in levels. But that inflammatory process allows for an increased absorption of tacrolimus in that situation with an increased bioavailability. Those are our interactions of absorption, and there are many in our organ transplant population. Interactions of distribution is next, and distribution is movement of drug between blood and various tissues so the drug can reach its site of activity. The most common interactions we see here happen through albumin. Mycophenolic acid is our only highly protein-bound drug. It's approximately 97% bound to albumin in the blood. When it's co-administered with other highly protein-bound drugs like salicylates, you can get an increase in free fraction of mycophenolic acid, and there's the potential for an increase in adverse events and an increase in efficacy. Unfortunately, we don't know the clinical consequences of this drug interaction, but it has been a documented interaction. The third piece is the interaction of metabolism, and this is what most folks consider to be the primary reason why we get drug interactions, and it's the most common interactions we see with cyclosporin and tacrolimus and sirolimus and everolimus. And these happen through CYP3A, both 4 and 5 isozyme systems. In general, CYP3A is found in heavy prevalence in the liver, but also found very commonly, especially in certain patient populations like African Americans and Asians and some Hispanics, in the gut, but it's also found in the kidney. And there are really three interactions of metabolism. There's a substrate and substrate metabolic interaction, an enzyme inhibitor, and an enzyme inducer. So first, we're going to start with our substrate. So if we take two drugs, drug X and drug Y, and this CYP3A isozyme is responsible for metabolizing both drugs, you're going to see you get a metabolite of drug X and a metabolite of drug Y. Because these are competitively acting on the same catalytic enzyme, you're going to see a small increase in concentrations of both drugs. This is commonly seen when co-administering tacrolimus and amlodipine, maybe a 5 or 10% increase in tacrolimus and amlodipine, potentially resulting in some adverse reaction, but generally not. Where we see the biggest harm is if either drug X or drug Y is an enzyme inhibitor. So in this case, let's say that drug Y is an enzyme inhibitor, and it inhibits this enzyme, and it results in a reduction in enzymatic activity, and you get a reduction in drug X metabolism. So this enzyme inhibition results in increased concentrations of drug X. This is commonly seen with co-administration of macrolide antibiotics, azole antifungals, non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, amiodarone. A number of different medications can increase tacrolimus, cyclosporin, and our mTOR inhibitors through inhibitory effects. And the important thing to note about enzyme inhibition is it happens almost instantaneously. So when you co-administer two drugs that inhibit, or one drug that inhibits cytochrome P450 enzymes, you're going to see that adverse sequelae, especially in the lab values of tacrolimus, very quickly, normally within days. The next piece is enzyme inhibition. So now imagine that drug Y is an enzyme inhibitor, or excuse me, an enzyme inducer. And again, it's sitting on top of this cytochrome P450. And what it does is it either increases the enzymatic activity. So now we have much more enzymes, or it decreases the degradation of those enzymes. And what that results in is a significant increase in drug X metabolism. And the adverse consequence of this is you get a significant reduction in drug X concentrations. So now imagine your tacrolimus-treated patients receiving phenytoin or phenobarbital or St. John's wort. You're going to get a significant induction interaction there. Now, the interesting thing here is that induction interactions often takes weeks before you reach full induction potential by your drug. So if you have a patient on tacrolimus who's just now starting phenobarbital or phenytoin or carbamazepine or St. John's wort, it can take up to 2 weeks before you get this full induction effect. So you're going to have to monitor the patient very closely over that time period. Consequently, it also takes 2 to 3 weeks for this enzyme to come back to normal after stopping the offending agent. So if you have enzyme induction and you stop the induction agent, you can result in increased metabolism for up to 2 to 3 weeks following that drug being removed. Now, even though we generally consider CYP3A both 4 and 5 as our major metabolic pathways, we also have a metabolic interaction when we look at azathioprine. Azathioprine is a prodrug for 6-mercaptopurine, and then the enzyme xanthine oxidase detoxifies 6-mercaptopurine into its inactive metabolite 6-thiouracate. We realize that xanthine oxidase is a common enzyme used for the formation of uric acid, and we have two enzyme xanthine oxidase inhibitors, both allopurinol and febuxostat. When you combine a xanthine oxidase inhibitor with azathioprine, you get a significant increase in 6-mercaptopurine levels that can result in significant myelosuppression to your patient. So use of azathioprine and your xanthine oxidase inhibitors is actually contraindicated, but if you have to use them, you need to reduce azathioprine doses by at least 75% and keep a very close eye on your patient's white blood cell count and platelet count because this is such a significant interaction. The next is our interactions of elimination, and this is most commonly seen with mycophenolic acid. And it's done through this process. So you have mycophenolate mofetil, or the enterocoated mycophenolic acid, passes through the gut where you get mycophenolic acid formation into the liver where it undergoes phase 2 metabolism. Phase 2 metabolism will either kick out mycophenolic acid into the systemic circulation or the glucuronide formation of mycophenolic acid. The glucuronide formation is an inactive substance, and it goes through a bile-dependent multidrug-resistant protein where it's secreted into the bile, brought back into the gut, and you get mycophenolic acid in the lower intestines. through your normal gut flora, you can cleave off that mycophenolic acid glucuronide, resulting in mycophenolic acid in the intestines, and you get a secondary absorption. So the traditional time concentration curve for mycophenolic acid has a big peak within hours of oral administration, and then a smaller secondary peak between 6 and 8 hours after its oral administration when you get the secondary absorption of mycophenolic acid. The interaction that we see here of significance is with cyclosporin and cholestyramine, both of which inhibit the allowance of mycophenolic acid glucuronide into the bile, and therefore you never get that secondary peak. Now, the final piece is the risk for pharmacodynamic drug interactions. Pharmacodynamic drug interactions are things that we use actually on a daily basis. So it's using drugs that share similar mechanisms of action or using drugs that have similar side effects. So first, let's talk about shared mechanisms. Imagine your patient that you induced with ATG are giving tacrolimus, mycophenolate, and corticosteroids. You're utilizing 4 immunosuppressants to totally immunosuppress your patient, but using smaller doses of each drug to limit adverse events. This is a common pharmacodynamic drug interaction that you're taking advantage of to immunosuppress your patient while limiting side effects. Now imagine that same patient with ATG induction on mycophenolic acid receiving sulfamethoxazole, trimethoprim, and valganciclovir, all of which are myelosuppressive. You're increasing your patient's risk for leukopenia or thrombocytopenia by combining these drugs. Probably the most common pharmacodynamic interaction we attempt to avoid is in interactions that result in concomitant nephrotoxicity. So avoiding the use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, aminoglycosides, amphotericin B, and other nephrotoxic drugs while you're co-administering the patient tacrolimus or cyclosporin. The final piece, because we don't have time to go through individual drug interactions and how to manage them, is general theory for management practice. And there are really 2 ways to manage drug interactions. The most important obviously starts with knowing the interaction exists, but then either managing it one of 2 ways. When you co-administer 2 drugs that have an interaction, especially if it's a pharmacokinetic interaction, you can do therapeutic drug monitoring to monitor concentrations and reduce the level of the offending drugs or the substrate, like reducing tacrolimus during enzyme inhibition after you see an increase in tacrolimus concentrations. The other is if you're giving an offending agent, such as an inhibitor or an inducer, that has a significant impact. For example, voriconazole will increase tacrolimus levels 3- to 5-fold. This is a population where generally you would want to empirically reduce the dose of tacrolimus so that you don't get adverse events associated with the concomitant administration. That's drug-drug interactions in theory. I hope you are able to take this and apply it to your patients in clinical practice. Thank you.